We rely on physicians and the American healthcare industry to keep us healthy. And when we're sick, we rely on them to keep us alive. Today's guest has been on both sides of that equation, and his books give us an insight normally reserved for insiders. He's Dr. Sandeep Jahar, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories that shape public life in the United States today. This week, we're joined by Dr. Sandeep Jahar, a cardiologist and author of acclaimed portrayals of healthcare in the United States. Sandeep, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So we want to get to your books, but we want to talk to you a little bit about you first. So you were born in India, and were you raised there?
I was born in India. My father was a plant geneticist, so he sort of moved around. So my childhood was kind of moving around from place to place. I spent some time in England, but we eventually settled in Southern California.
And when did you know that you were interested in medicine?
Well, when I was growing up, my parents actually wanted me to become a doctor. You know, they were immigrants to this country, and to them, a career in medicine was a way to do well and do good. My grandfather, actually, in New Delhi, was a family physician. I would spend time with him in his clinic. But, you know, I really wasn't sure I wanted to go into medicine. I ended up going to Berkeley and studied physics. And what really turned me was a dear friend got sick with a disease called lupus, you know, which had no cure. And gradually, in the process of learning more about the disease and trying to help her, I got more interested in medicine.
So you say you studied physics. You did study physics, and you got a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD in physics. I mean, that's quite an education. But then you made that transition. It was your friend getting sick that made you, and where did you go from there? Armed with these three degrees in physics, now you want to become a doctor. How's that work?
That didn't work well with my parents. Because my dad had told me all along, you know, I'd love for you to become a doctor. You know, he's a plant geneticist, and his favorite saying when I was growing up was, "Non-science is nonsense." And so,
really?
Oh yeah. So he really wanted me to pursue a career in medicine, if not medicine, physics. So actually, when I told him that I was not going to become a doctor, I was going to go into physics, he said, "Oh, okay." And just to give you an idea of the culture I grew up in, it rebellion in an Indian immigrant family was saying no to a career in medicine and then going into physics. You know? So it was,
rebel with a cause.
Yes, exactly. So, but yeah, I from Berkeley, I actually, I went to St. Louis, to Washington University School of Medicine, and I had a short foray. I did a science journalism fellowship at Time Magazine the summer before I went to medical school.
So with the PhD, you were at Time Magazine doing this science journalism internship.
Yeah, so the internship, it was a fellowship sponsored by the Mass Media, by the AAAS. It's called the Mass Media Fellowship. And it's for, you know, graduate students or scientists who wanted to, you know, get more involved in journalism. So I applied with my PhD, and still, much to my amazement, I got it. I wrote an essay, and so they placed me at the Washington Bureau of Time Magazine. So the first story I did actually had nothing to do with science. They told me to go to the Capitol building and get a quote from Bob Dole.
Really?
Did you get it?
I did. Everyone, you know, he was the majority leader at the time, and everyone else wanted a quote too, including reporters from the New York Times and other places. So, with my physics background, I sort of thought the problem through, and I figured, you know, as an intern, he wasn't going to give me any time. So I was just going to hang out by the bathroom, because eventually he was going to have to go to the bathroom. And everyone else was sort of around the rotunda, and I just parked myself in the bathroom. But eventually he came, and I spewed out, I imagine was a bunch of gibberish, saying something to the effect of, you know, Mr. Dole, can I please talk to you about... And he kind of looked down at me, he was a tall guy, kind of looked down at me, and kept walking, completely ignored me. And then about half an hour later, not wanting to fail in my first journalistic assignment, I went to his press secretary, and I'm talking to him, trying to convince him to let me speak to Senator Dole, and Dole walks up. And I'll never forget this. He said, this is Sandeep Jahar. He is an intern at Time Magazine, and he wants a quote from me about America's working poor. Please set up a 10-minute phone conversation. So somehow, the gibberish that I spewed out, he managed to filter out everything that was unimportant, retain what was important, and anyway, I talked to him the next day, and I got my quote.
That's awesome.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
So obviously we want you for our cardiologist if you're this creative. So you came east and you're now in New York.
Yes.
As a practicing cardiologist and also as an author. What made you come east, or what motivated you to come to this side of the coast?
I'd always wanted to live in New York, and my brother, who assumes a pretty big role in my first book, Intern, was a cardiology fellow at New York Hospital. On the Upper East Side, so...
He pleased your father.
Yeah, he did all along. He knew he wanted to be a doctor from the get-go. So he encouraged me to apply, and I ended up going to New York and started my training.
So you mentioned Time Magazine, but that's not your only foray with journalism and writing.
Right. Right. So before I went to New York, I pitched a piece to the New York Times, and... Again, still to my amazement, they said yes, and it was a piece about a hospital in Louisiana, and they said sure, and they flew me down there, and now, before that, sort of the foundation of that was that I did a internship at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch before I finished medical school. I spent about 6 months.
So how does that, I got a PhD in history, and I knew I didn't want to necessarily teach, but I wanted a career in policy, and I was definitely the black sheep of that family, right? There was just a sort of a skepticism of your seriousness as a scholar if you didn't want to go teach and be a tenure-track professor somewhere. What's the reaction in med school to you with your, first of all, your PhD in physics already, but also sort of dabbling in journalism on the side?
I don't think the deans knew what to do with me. neither did my family, really. But, you know, it was, you know, I had always really enjoyed writing when I was growing up. And, it was something that I really wanted to do. And when they offered me the internship, I did have some trepidation about it, just, you know, finding the time. But we had a very good transcription service for medical school lectures. So I would go to med school in the morning, and then I would go to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I think 3 or 4 afternoons a week, and then I'd obviously read up the lectures, the med school lectures that night. But at the Post-Dispatch, I'd walk in, and my editor, a wonderful guy named John Curley, would say, or somebody else would say, you know, we noticed there were a bunch of wasps stinging people in Forest Park. You know, find out what you can about it and file a 400-word story by 6 p.m. And so I'd call a bunch of experts and try to figure out what was going on. And then, you know, I had to work on deadlines. So, like, within 5 hours or so, I'd have to have something
that we could file. So it was really good practice to write stories and report stories.
So you decided to write a book. Your first book was Intern, A Doctor's Initiation, published in 2009. What did you reveal in that book? And what was the reaction to your revelations?
Well, so Intern grew out of pieces I had written for The Times. When I started my internship, I published a story, and then my editor at The Times said, you know, you're an intern. I don't think you can have a lot of time to travel and report stories, but why don't you write some dispatches from the hospital? And so we started a column called Cases, and I wrote a bunch of pieces my first couple of years, actually first 3 years or so. Eventually, I got an agent, and he encouraged me to write a book, and so I got a contract with Forrest Rousson Giroux to write a memoir about my internship. So the focus really was on, I mean, there were a lot of things. What really motivated me at the beginning of my career in terms of writing was stuff that I just found puzzling. You know, things that just didn't make sense to me. Like, for example, when I was an intern, there was a guy in the hospital who couldn't swallow. He had, some degree of dementia, and I think he'd had a stroke, but he had a very difficult time swallowing. So the team was getting ready to put in a feeding tube, but he didn't want the feeding tube. And in fact, whenever I would talk to him about it, he would say, like, his greatest pleasure in life was tasting food. And so I would ask, well, why are we doing this? And people would say, well, he doesn't have capacity to, you know, make this decision. And that really bothered me. So one day I went to his room and I said, look, you know, if you continue to swallow food or drink, you could swallow into your lungs and get pneumonia, and that's why, and it could kill you. That's why we want to put in this feeding tube. And he reiterated that he didn't want it. So I just did a little bedside swallow test. I gave him some orange juice to drink. And it was kind of a crazy thing that I probably wouldn't do again. But as an intern, you know, you sort of haven't bought into the culture as much. You know, you're new, you're questioning things. You know, when you become an attending, you kind of buy into things more. And so it still amazes me that I did this, but I gave him a little swallow test and he passed, and I called the surgeons and said, please don't put in the feeding tube. He passed the swallow test. And eventually he ended up discharged without a feeding tube. So it was those kinds of things, the conundrum that you see a lot, ethical issues that you see throughout your career, but that register more with you when you're early on in your career because you haven't seen stuff that I would write about.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at J.M. Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is the acclaimed author and cardiologist, Dr. Sandeep Juhar, whose new book, Heart, A History, is hailed as a personal and moving look at the medical understanding of the vital organ, as well as the medical pioneers who transformed the way we care for it. Dr. Juhar is on Twitter, too, at S-J-A-U-H-A-R. I want to press you just a little bit. So what was different about you or your role as an intern that would make you willing to administer that test then that you wouldn't now?
You know, I think that as an intern, you question things more. Everything's new. You know, you see your first death, you know, you write your first prescription, you're not really as embedded in the hospital as you are when you progress in your career. So, and I think you're in some ways more likely to question and, you know, even break rules. And so that was, I think, what motivated me at that point.
So your next book, which came out in 2014, was another bestseller. It was Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. What did you reveal in that book, which was controversial within the field?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I finished my training, I started my first job. It was 19 years after I graduated from high school. I finally had my first job, because I did the PhD, and then I did the internship, med school internship, residency fellowship, everything added up. So it was like almost 2 decades of training. And so I was ready to, you know, kind of relax, you know, in some way, you know, just, you know, just not, you know, kind of reap some of the rewards for all those sleepless nights. I was very naive about it. So I would go to the doctor's lounge, and I would hear doctors talk about how miserable they were. And it wasn't about the money or the paperwork or, you know, the usual stuff. It was really more of what I considered an existential crisis, which is that the doctors had certain ideals when they went into medicine that medicine, the medical system, wasn't allowing them to uphold. You know, ideals about helping patients and about, you know, doing the right thing. And so many of my colleagues were just really upset that the system was constraining them from doing the right thing, the stuff that they had always expected themselves to do when they reached that position. And so I started to kind of conceptualize that as a sort of midlife crisis, because American medicine, at least when I started writing the book, was about 40 years old in the sense that it was 40 years since the Nixon administration passed the HMO Act, or that sort of brought managed care into American medicine. And then I sort of developed my own disillusionment and my own kind of midlife crisis. So I wrote about that and how it intertwined with what I called American medicine's midlife crisis.
So I guess I'm wondering if you can give us a specific example about the barrier to doctors doing what they had always wanted to do. Is it about the bureaucracy of the insurance industry? Is it the broader healthcare debate? What is it that is so disillusioning?
You know, let me give you one example. There's a guy who needed a valve replaced, and the surgeon calls me up and wanted me to evaluate the patient, and I deemed the patient really not requiring valve surgery. But another doctor, who had actually sent the patient to the surgeon, the referring physician, wanted the valve surgery done. So there was a difference. And the surgeon says to me, you know, he might not need it, but I feel like I have to do it. Because the referring physician wants it, and basically I don't want to lose his business. And I don't want to lose your business either. So I feel kind of stuck. And it's that kind of thing, where business considerations of volume and finances enter into medical decision making, that I think is most upsetting.
How pervasive is that?
It's very pervasive. It's all over American medicine. We spend the most of any country. Our outcomes aren't that great, most doctors don't go to medical school to become businessmen,
right.
or women. And but financial considerations are just really front and center today in hospitals, yeah. And it's not easy.
Is that a function of? So you know, we've had healthcare debates now in this country now, you know, for generations.
Yeah.
Is that is the predominance of the business decision or the business factors in decision making, is that a function of the business model in healthcare, or what's driving that?
I mean, there's so many things driving it, but you know, one of the direct considerations for physicians is that reimbursement has been cut, and so physicians, especially primary care physicians, feel pressured to see patients every 8 to 10 minutes, right, to sort of maintain revenue so that they can pay their office expenses. It was amazing to me to discover that a lot of primary care physicians can't meet basic expenses of their office. In fact, a lot of them are no longer going into the hospital to see their own patients when those patients are hospitalized, because the financial calculus is that if I leave the office, I have to drive to the hospital, park, walk into the building, see the patient, write some orders, check the labs, do all that, and it just doesn't make sense to do that for two or three patients.
That's too much opportunity cost.
Exactly, yeah. Where you can stay in the office and see 5, 6, 7, 8 patients during that same time. So,
and there are many people in and out of medicine who would say the most important healthcare professional is the primary care physician.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are a lot of people not going into that specialty because of what you just mentioned.
Yeah.
So let's get to your new book, which is a bit of a departure. It's not an indictment. It's called Heart History. It's gotten great reviews already. It's an Amazon Best of the Month. Library Journal called it compelling, and it definitely communicates the beauty, mystery, and scientific wonder of the human heart. Tell us about your book.
Well, I'm a cardiologist. I've always found the heart fascinating. The heart is, has some, very unique properties in the body. The brain cannot function without a beating heart, but the heart can function without a functioning brain, at least for the short term. The heart, the amount of work it does is staggering. It pumps, beats 3 billion times and pumps about the equivalent of a swimming pool of blood within a week. And the heart is self-sustaining. It doesn't just pump blood to other organs, but it pumps blood to itself. So the scientific properties are very, very interesting. And on top of it, the heart is a metaphorical entity that has occupied our cultural imagination for millennia. The heart was always thought to be the locus of the emotions, the seat of the soul. So all those things really fascinated me about the heart. In addition to all that, I have a very malignant family history, and both my grandfathers died, one very prematurely, my mother died of heart disease. So for all those reasons, I was just very interested in learning about the heart and also writing about the history of the heart.
So you tell some of your personal story in your book, and Sanjay Gupta, who is the CNN chief medical correspondent, correctly called it a personal journey besieged with a tragic history of heart disease. He sets out to change his preordained fate. It takes a degree of courage to talk about your own health and your own heart.
Yeah.
And you do. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I mean, as sort of motivation for, why I decided to write the book. But really, the most compelling thing for me in the end was that the history of the heart is just so interesting. Wayne, as you know, you wrote a great book about a heart surgeon, and the heart, up until the late 19th century, but I want the viewers to understand, was never operated on. Every other organ in the body had been an object of surgery, including the brain, but not the heart. And the reason why is, it's pretty clear. first of all, the heart's always moving, so it's very hard to cut into a moving object. The heart's filled with blood, so if you cut it open, you would bleed to death. And if you stop the heart and isolate it so that blood isn't coursing through it, then you would develop brain damage and kidney damage. So this is an incredibly difficult problem to solve. How do you operate on an organ that's responsible for the sustenance of every other organ? And the solution to that problem has a fascinating history. It's involved, at one point, probably the most innovative surgeon of the 20th century, a guy named Walt Lillehei, Wayne knows very well, he wrote a book about him, decided to hook up two people. He hook up a parent to the child and have the parent serve as the living heart-lung machine for the child who is going to be operated on. Now, you think about how fascinating and bizarre that was, and how much flack Lillehei got for that. You know, this was the first operation in human history where the mortality was potentially 200%, right? To have a normal human being potentially sacrificed to save a child. So that history is fascinating, and eventually gave way to the development of the heart-lung machine. But I talk about that history along with patient stories and my own story, and I try to braid all those stories together into, you know, what I hope is a tribute to this organ.
You do it, you weave it brilliantly. It's a wonderful book.
It is a wonderful book, and Sandeep Juhar, we're so thrilled to have you here. The book is Heart, A History. Thank you for being with us. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.